This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, changing our cities to make them more people-centric, not car-centric. We talk first to disability mobility advocate Anna Zivartz about her book, When Driving is Not an Option, Steering Away from Car Dependency. Then city planner Dan Pietkowski tells us about how bicycles can make cities, and even suburbs, more people-friendly. His book is Bicycle City, Riding the Bike Boom to a Brighter Future. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. One-third of people living in the U.S. don't have a driver's license. The majority of involuntary non-drivers are disabled, lower-income, unhoused, formerly incarcerated, undocumented immigrants, kids, young people, and the elderly. That's a lot of people. They're also largely invisible due to a mobility system designed almost exclusively for drivers. Anna Zivartz is a disability activist, a non-driver, and author of When Driving is Not an Option, Steering Away from Car Dependency. Her book shines a light on the reality for non-drivers and explains how improving our transportation system with non-drivers in mind will create a better quality of life for everyone. It's out from Island Press. Anna Zivartz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks.
This book, When Driving is Not an Option, you actually start out with your own story. You can't drive because of a neurological condition that you were born with called nystagmus. What is that?
Yeah, so nystagmus, you know, doctors don't fully understand how it all works, but basically something in my brain is telling my eyes to move all the time. So whenever I'm conscious, my eyes are shaking a little bit. And that, you know, makes it difficult for me to see far distances, see details, see fast moving objects, a lot of things that, you know, compound to make it really not safe for me to drive. You know, some people with nystagmus are able to drive or drive under limited circumstances, but my nystagmus is such that it's not safe. I did, you know, I wrote about it in the book. I tried to drive as a teenager, tried to learn how to drive. It didn't go well. I definitely couldn't pass the vision test at the DMV. And so, yeah, I have always gotten around using other kinds of transportation.
That must be very difficult.
You know, growing up in a semi-rural area in a state without a lot of transit, it felt really isolating, and I didn't really have a vision for how I was going to function as an adult in the world. I didn't really have models. And then I moved to New York City, and that was wonderful. There I could be, you know, a full member of society, really, because I could get where I needed to go on the subway. It was never a question of, you know, oh, I can't go to this thing because, you know, transportation is too difficult. And, you know, it was never an option. Like oftentimes job applications will require driver's licenses. That wasn't something I encountered in New York for, you know, office work. And yeah, then, you know, so it really, it didn't limit me there. Here I'm back now where I grew up in Washington State. It is a big limitation. It is really hard to get around here. There's the assumption that everyone drives everywhere, especially as a parent. Yeah, I know that it's possible to build a world where it's not such a limitation. So that sort of gives me hope. And part of the reason I wrote this book was that, you know, it doesn't have to be such a limitation.
So there are a lot more reasons people don't drive than disability. For example, affordability. Talk about the affordability issue. How many people don't drive because of that?
It's, you know, the cost of driving is high and it's going up. I think, you know, insurance rates in particular are really increasing in a lot of states. And, you know, the cost of gas, the cost of more expensive vehicles, as they get, you know, bigger and fancier, there's not affordable options. And so it really has priced a lot of people out of that. Or, you know, the high cost of housing, high cost of other basic necessities means that, you know, budgets are really, really tight. And sometimes it either is a choice to afford a car and give up other things, or a choice to give up the car for a household. And so when our communities are designed around car mobility, makes it a really difficult and painful choice too often.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people who are homeless live in their cars because they need their car to get to work. So they live in their car rather than living in a house.
Yeah, right? Because if it's one or the other, you know, and you have to get somewhere and there's not that option, yeah, what are you going to choose?
And this also affects disabled people because you point out, well, I mean, a lot of people who work in home care are paid very little, so they can't afford to have a car. So what is the connection with the disabled people who depend on them?
Yeah, I mean, if you are struggling to afford a car or a reliable car, right? You know, you're using a car that has problems and you can't necessarily afford to fix those things. You know, then your ability to you know, get where you need to go can be hard. And I have many friends who, you know, rely on home care workers, and it can be really hard to find someone. You know, the pay is low, and there's a lot of turnover. And you know, if you need someone to help you know, get dressed, get out of bed, and that person can't get there because their car broke down or they don't have access to a car, that can be really challenging. So before I started working in the disability community, I spent many years working for labor unions, working with service workers, hotel workers, janitors, and you know, in places like New York City, where there is a transit system where people don't have to necessarily own a car to get where they need to go, it can be that's one less thing people have to stretch a budget to cover. But, you know, that's not the case in a lot of our communities, or the parts of our cities that are the most walkable or have the best transit are then, you know, the most elite, the most expensive, the most desirable parts of our communities as well, right? And so people who need those options the most, perhaps because they can't afford a car, are priced further and further out into the exurbs, where there's not, you know, there's not transit, there aren't sidewalks, and it can be really, really challenging to get around without driving.
You know, I'm spending time on the people who can't drive because I think a lot of people just think about it as being disabled people. But it's so much more than that. And you point out that there are also racial disparities. You quote somebody in the book who said, talking about the cost of, first of all, policing the targets, racial minorities, basically in order to swell the city coffers, you know, is often what's happened. And she said they pull you over for anything. They claim they can't see your tags, and it's just the angle they were looking at your car. Tell us about this woman and what happened to her.
Yeah, I mean, we see big disparities in car ownership, and especially among black households in America. I think are 3 times less likely to have a vehicle, right? So, and a lot of that has to do with racialized poverty, but also with enforcement. And so this experience, I was working as a contractor for the ACLU, observing courtrooms in Memphis, Tennessee, and it was shocking to me. Because the folks who were having to show up and make these appearances in court for, you know, unpaid fines and fees, usually related to like things like, you know, not having tags or tinted windows or seat belts, right? It was overwhelmingly black. I was one of the few white people in this space, other than the judges, right, and some of the attorneys. And then the compounding fines and fees were a big piece of it as well, where, you know, people couldn't necessarily afford to get a broken taillight fixed, right? And then they would end up in court, and then unpaid fines and fees would result in people's licenses being suspended. And then they would, if they wanted to maintain a job, need to drive with a suspended license, maybe they get pulled over again. And you know, it just sort of compounds. And so that system of punishing people for not having enough money to maintain something that is super expensive is really dysfunctional, and it just makes the problem worse.
Yeah, exactly. And another issue are immigrants. I know in my area, I live on the eastern end of Long Island. We have, I mean, I'd say some 30% of our workforce, at least, maybe more, up to 40%, are immigrants. Now, of course, many of them are documented and they can legally drive. And actually, in New York State, even if you're undocumented, I'm pretty sure you can still get a license.
Yeah.
But I still see a lot of people using bicycles, often bicycles that don't fit them. So I know they probably don't have the money to, you know, they're not high-end bicycles. And I'm thinking a lot of these folks are people who either can't afford a car or are just loath to enter into a system, even though you can have a driver's license if you're an immigrant, undocumented immigrant. So talk about the issue of immigration and how that hurts our workforce, you know, and so many people who we depend on, who have jobs that we need them to have, can't get to work.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's the cost thing, right? Where we're, you know, if you're earning lower wages and, you know, really struggling to afford housing or wanting to, you know, save money to send, you know, back to family members, right? Like then asking people to then invest in a car and pay for gas and, right, those are additional expenses. So that's definitely a barrier for many recent immigrants to our country. You know, there's also a lot of states where you can't get a driver's license if you're undocumented. Or, you know, because of some of the crackdowns around immigration law or, you know, public charge where folks who accept public benefits, right, then lose the opportunity to become naturalized citizens, right? There's a reticence to necessarily have your information in the system, even if you are undocumented and could get a driver's license legally in some states, to then go in and have all your information, right, in the hands of the government. That could be something that feels unsafe, right? And so, you know, we would be better off if we had alternatives, right, where people don't feel like they have to either, you know, take those risks, either financial risks or risks of deportation. If we had transit, if we had safe places to bike and roll, you know, that those would be better solutions. There's also, you know, the stress of if you didn't necessarily have to drive in the country where you came from and then coming to the U.S. and having to learn how to drive and navigate in a country where perhaps English isn't your first language, that can feel like a lot of pressure as well. You know, learning transit systems is also stressful, you know, but driving can feel unsafe or, you know, that's an extra burden. And so, you know, one thing we're talking about here in Seattle right now is we have the FIFA World Cup coming in a couple of years. And, you know, there's going to be a huge number of tourists coming from all over the world. And I think people aren't necessarily prepared. I mean, we can't physically have that many people arriving by car and planning to rent cars. Apparently, there just aren't enough rental cars, right? And our road systems aren't designed for that. And people are going to be coming expecting to be able to take transit from the airport, take transit to these games. And but we're such a car-dependent state that we're not equipped to have, you know, folks who are expecting a transit system or places to safely bike. We just don't have that set up here. And that's, you know, I think this one event is sort of a unique thing, sort of like, you know, it's a huge, huge event, but we're not thinking about how to really be intentional about building communities that could work without that car dependence because we're so in this rut right now.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anna Zivartz about her book, When Driving is Not an Option, Steering Away from Car Dependency. Anna Zivartz is a disability activist and program director of the Disability Mobility Initiative of Disability Rights Washington. Then another non-driver category that you talk about, which I certainly think about, are seniors. I'm a senior. I can still drive, but I remember when my mother could no longer drive. So I know that that's something that may happen. And you say a lot of Americans will spend the last 7 to 10 years of their life unable to safely drive. So that's an issue, too. And I know some people are saying, oh, well, they're going to be self-driving cars by then. It's not going to be an issue. Talk a little bit about what you think about self-driving cars as a solution for people who can't drive.
Yeah, you know, I think when we talk about, I mean, just to go back to seniors for a moment, I think a lot of people have that experience in their own families, right? Of someone aging out of driving, and that can be really difficult if you know that person is living somewhere where they need to be able to drive to continue to live independently. You know, I am frustrated about the conversation around self-driving cars because, especially for blind and low vision folks, I think it's been dangled in front of this community for a long time as this like, oh, well, you know, we don't need to take transit or make transit investments or think about sidewalks because we're going to have self-driving cars and then you can just use that. And the reality is, A, you know, they're not here yet. And B, even if they do exist, they're probably not going to be affordable to a lot of folks who currently are non-drivers, including many folks in the disability community, just because of, you know, the cost of developing that technology is, it's going to, and just, you know, the way these things are being priced, the way we see with ride hail now, it's not an affordable option for folks who are in fixed income or on disability payments, or even, you know, folks who don't earn a ton of money as tech workers, right? These things are the ride hail is expensive. It's also not wheelchair accessible. And so that excludes a lot of folks as well. And it doesn't exist. I mean, where we see with ride hail, and I assume the same thing will be true for autonomous vehicles for the foreseeable future, is in more rural areas and lower income areas in particular, in more rural low income areas. These it just doesn't exist as a service that you can rely on. You can't, you know, there aren't ride hail or even taxis, you know, available in much of our country. And we have a lot of folks who are priced out of cities or don't live in cities, and can't drive. And so I don't see it as something that we can count on. And I also don't think it's a the solution that we want to count on either, right? It assumes that, you know, we're going to have to then build, continuing to sort of build out car infrastructure and car dependency. And that's not where we need to go from a climate perspective or a public health perspective.
And just to say, we didn't talk about kids, which is another issue as well, but you just mentioned climate. So talk about the climate impact of our car culture as being another reason why we need to build an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, there's this narrative right now that electrification is going to save us from the, you know, the climate impacts of car dependency. That's not happening. We're not electrifying fast enough. And even if we were to fully electrify our fleets by the time that we're supposed to in order to mitigate climate change, there's so many other public health impacts of car dependency that we don't erase when we switch to electric vehicles. For example, all the tire dust or noise pollution, or you know, the public health implications of crashes. The electric vehicles are heavier than non-electric vehicles, and so we're seeing, you know, even increased pedestrian and cyclist deaths as a result of these bigger and heavier vehicles on our roads. So yeah, in Washington State, you know, we transportation emissions have been one of the largest source of our greenhouse gases for a while now. Part of it is because we have a lot of hydropower that, you know, so we haven't been burning coal for electricity. But you know, but we haven't really tackled it. Even with a lot of electric vehicle subsidies, it's just not making a dent because electric vehicles are expensive. People aren't switching to them. We don't have, you know, the charging thing figured out for folks who don't live in single family homes with garages they can charge in, right? There's just so much we haven't really sorted out. And rather than digging us deeper into the system of car dependency by making it all feasible for us to have electric vehicles, I think we should be thinking less about individual vehicle ownership and more about how can we have transit networks, electrified transit networks, that meet our more of our needs.
And now to talk about that, and it does seem like that is not as much part of the plan. I mean, even the Inflation Reduction Act really focuses on electric vehicles, individual transportation, not on developing public transportation, although there's some money for that. But public transportation has its own problem, which is that it's often too expensive. I was reading the other day in the Times, New York Times, there was an article about New York City fare beaters. I mean, it's like a something like over 40% of people using the subway don't pay. Buses. In the subway, it's more like 12 or 15%. These are systems that are really suffering post-pandemic. You say there's like a triple whammy: COVID relief funding drying up, fare collection down, and expenses are growing. So how can we do public transportation right in a way that is economically just?
Yeah, no, I mean, the question of how to fund transit, I think, is a big and important one. And especially in our big systems like New York City, right? Like some of the for small areas, for rural areas, for small transit agencies, the fare collection often isn't a big part of revenue. It doesn't pay for the operating the system significantly. And so it's relatively easy for smaller systems to go fare free. And we've seen that in Washington State, where most of our state now, the rural transit is free. And that's great. It's so easy. I mean, rather than trying to be like, oh my gosh, I have to download 6 different apps to try to pay, or scramble and find quarters, and you don't have quarters and nobody has quarters. And, it really does, you know, I think we can be thinking about different ways to pay for transit. For these bigger systems, it's much trickier because the numbers are much bigger. And I think it's really important for us to not sacrifice the frequency and the coverage of transit in making it fare free. We need to make sure, you know, people are only going to use transit if it gets, you know, gets us where we need to go. But we can also be thinking more creatively about how we pay for it. And I would love to see in New York City, like, if, you know, congestion pricing, obviously there was a lot that was going to get funded with that as far as upgrades to the system, accessibility. You know, wouldn't it be great if we got to the day where, you know, where the system could actually be free? In Washington State, we have commute trip reduction funding, and it would be terrific if we were getting to the place where large employers and all employers were actually, through, you know, those payroll taxes, fully funding transit. A big percentage of our system here in the Seattle area is funded through large employers already. And it would be great if it was just, you know, standard, right? When you go to work, part of what we're covering is that transit for you to get to and from work. It's already funding a pretty significant part of the system. Wouldn't it be great if it could fully fund it for everyone, so it wasn't a question of affordability?
And now talk about housing. Connect this whole thing of transportation alternatives to the car to the housing crisis.
Yes. That's the ultimate piece, right? I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, we have built, our country is incredibly car dependent because we have intentionally incentivized building further and further out. Like, we've, you know, this development's patterns that where land is cheap on the outskirts, and we're able to sort of subsidize that expansion through a really car-centric network. We're getting things further and further away from each other. And we're not, at the same time that we're sort of spreading out, we're not able to change our land uses to become more dense easily. And so housing has become increasingly unaffordable. And, you know, as we see, right, I mentioned earlier, right, that folks who can't afford to live closer to where things are priced out. And then they are either locked into, you know, owning a car they can't afford, or they can't afford a car and they're locked out of a lot of opportunities because they can't get around. And so, you know, that land use piece is so, so essential. And how we zone and what kinds of ways we're incentivizing communities to build denser, to build services close to where people live as well, right? So we have medical care, we have schools, we have childcare, we have grocery stores, we have, you know, recreation centers, libraries, close to where people live, and we're not separating these functions so that people have to travel really far distances to get, you know, their daily needs met. But it's counter to so many of our development patterns now. And, you know, even in progressive states like Washington, we see these proposals to, like, let's build more affordable housing, but we're going to do it on land that's owned by Department of Natural Resources. So these sites that are way out, you know, in the exurbs and in, you know, greenfields, like, that's not where we need to be building affordable housing. We need to be building it closer in. So people who can't afford a vehicle can still have access to where they need to go.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder why there isn't more building on, like, the second story of retail centers, you know, villages, even rural areas like where I live. there's a village, you know, there are villages in each hamlet that we have. Even if it's just a tiny little shopping center, there's a second story to those stores. Why are we not building housing up there? And I think it's because those are zoned commercial. They're not zoned residential.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's so frustrating when you see like historic sort of town centers or streetcar suburbs, and there's this desire to preserve things the way they are and make sure that, you know, existing businesses aren't displaced, which is important, but also then it just sort of locks us in, right? And there's no capacity to be like, okay, well, with this, can we be really intentional and make sure this business can stay here on the first floor, but then we're going to build four stories of apartments on top of it? And, you know, I see that in my street in Seattle, that we're not willing to, you know, upzone from these one-story commercial areas because we're too afraid of change. And we desperately need housing, and we need housing along these corridors where there is transit.
So you say in the book, we need to organize because there are powerful interests who are invested in the building of roads, who are invested in the car culture. There's a lot of NIMBYism, which seems to happen every time something is proposed to be built that would allow more people to live more densely. People don't want to have more growth. So talk about building coalitions and organizing. What's being done? What still needs to be done?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of discourse in this space happens, or feel like, oh, I know we need to change things, and I'm going to write about it, and here I am writing about it. But ultimately, what's going to change people's attitudes is you know, people showing up and building a political coalition big enough to change and push back against the status quo. And you know, here in Washington, I think we sort of started to change the conversation at our state legislature when we were able to show up and start testifying during the pandemic because everything went remote. And so instead of, you know, like a 6-hour bus ride to get to our state capitol to testify, we could get people who normally would never have had the opportunity to have their voices heard in some of these hearings on transportation budgets and talking about, hey, I can't drive and I still need to go places and I really want to see funding for transit, or I really want to see better sidewalks in my community. And, you know, doing that at a scale large enough to challenge sort of who is normally in those hearings, which are the folks who, you know, benefit from road building, who, you know, who can drive places, who don't understand that there are a lot of constituents in their communities, perhaps, who that's not an option for, and who want something really different. And so I do think, you know, that getting different people in the room and building bigger coalitions that really do make sure to highlight the voices of people who have the least choices is how we begin to shift things.
Well, the book is really an easy read and so informative. When Driving Is Not an Option, Steering Away from Car Dependency. I think it's one that, you know, a lot of different people would be interested in reading, not just disability activists, but also bicyclists, climate activists. All of us are really invested in a better transportation system. Thank you so much, Anna Zivartz, for talking with us here about the book.
Thank you. It's a great conversation.
Anna Zivartz is a disability activist and program director of the Disability Mobility Initiative of Disability Rights Washington. Next up, how a revolution in bike technology could make our cities and towns more people-centric. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. When Dan Pietkowski moved to New York City after college, he got a job as a bike messenger. It was really hard work, but it gave him a view of the city that inspired visions of community and connection that car culture makes impossible. So he became an urban planner with a mission to make cities more bikeable. In his book, Bikeable City, Piatkowski brings a global perspective. He shares his experience moving from the U.S. to Oslo, Norway, where he witnessed the benefits of the city's car-free livability program. His book explores the role of bicycles, e-bikes, and cargo bikes in reshaping urban spaces. He tells us that sustainable, people-centered cities can thrive without being dominated by cars, and they can be part of ensuring our planet will remain livable for us and future generations. Dan Piatkowski, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
So you are an urban planner, and you moved from Lincoln, Nebraska, where you found yourself despairing for cities confronting our climate emergency, and you moved to Oslo, Norway, where we're speaking to you right now. Why did you despair for our cities in response to the climate crisis?
So to start with, the despair began long before moving to Lincoln, Nebraska. I lived in Lincoln for about 5 years where I was working at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. But the despair for our cities, it started with something that I couldn't really define when I was just young and growing up in suburban Phoenix. And so I sort of like viscerally experienced a lot of the things that now I know as an urban planner are the result of car-based suburban lifestyles, you know, depending on my mom for rides to anywhere. The sort of the isolation that comes from not being able to have transportation independence as a young person growing up, those sorts of things was really the start of that despair. And then, you know, then becoming an academic and a researcher allowed me to understand the mechanisms behind that more clearly.
And you moved to Norway. You got a job there. What did you find there that inspired you? And talk about the car-free livability program.
So a lot of different things inspired me about the move to Norway. But certainly the most important policy piece of the last 10 years in Oslo has been this car-free livability program. So for a little bit of history, Oslo was not really on the radar of cities leading the charge to become more sustainable and more livable until quite recently. So now Oslo is often top three, even the top of global sustainable city ranks. And that is mostly can be traced back to this car-free livability program that began in 2014, 2015, and really kind of started rolling around 2019. The most important thing that they did is they didn't quite close streets to cars completely, but they really reframed streets. So instead of having a downtown street that has narrow sidewalks, parking on both sides, and two lanes of traffic in the middle, they turned it into big, wide sidewalks, no parking, and perhaps one lane that can be opened or closed based on the needs for emergency services. So, like, pretty extreme in the sense of limiting the amount of traffic and stuff like that. But it was most of these early efforts were done in the downtown area of Oslo. And that was really beneficial to the program because a lot of people visit the downtown area, whether it's tourists or people going in every day, but very few people live in that downtown core. So they were actually able to get a lot of things in place that maybe would have been more challenging to do in places where people would be facing a dramatic change to what's happening in front of their house. The benefit of doing that there then also is people could go and experience it and decide, hey, do I want this in front of my house?
And other cities have begun experimenting with some of those similar things as well. New York is. But before we talk about that, I want to go back to you. You write in the book, Bicycle City, Riding the Bike Boom to a Brighter Future. You say that you didn't grow up with bikes, but then you moved to New York. You became a bike messenger, which is a highly dangerous and difficult job. And then you worked in a bike shop, and then you became an urban planner. So what did working in the bike industry teach you?
God, that's a great question. What it taught me that led to writing the book was it taught me about the fact that everybody can experience a city differently, the same city differently. You know, that extends to all sorts of things, sort of individual characteristics, where we live, where we're from, what language we speak, are the level of ability we might have. But for me, it was riding a bicycle and experiencing a city in a way that I had not ever experienced it before. And that was really enlightening and freeing in the sense of me thinking about the potential for cities.
So you say the bicycles are an intermediary between where we are in this country, auto-dependent, and where we want to be, or we should want to be, which is people-centric. What does it mean to be people-centric instead of auto-dependent?
I think what that means is just a reshuffling of priorities a little bit. Right now, if we look at the way that our cities function, particularly in the U.S., but it's not just the U.S., you know, I mean, lots of cities and across Europe and across the rest of the world are quite auto-dependent too. But if we look at most of our cities in the U.S., the first, best, and oftentimes only way to get around is by a car. And that causes lots of problems for everybody. You know, it causes basic access problems for a lot of people. Cars are expensive. You have to have a license to drive them. You have to have a level of ability to use them. Kids can't get around independently. And then there's all of the sustainability problems that come from having really sprawling cities. You know, it's very carbon intensive to have big parking lots and big wide roads. And so if we start to reshuffle that, you know, the priority list and put people on top instead of cars on top, then we can start thinking about how do we build our cities accordingly. And that can mean densifying cities. It can also mean just mean slowing traffic. It can mean adding nicer sidewalks and bike lanes. You know, in policy terms, it can mean zoning that allows for mixed use development. So having housing and businesses right next to each other or on top of each other. I think actually that's probably the most important part is the idea is to allow cities more freedom to be the things that people want them to be instead of trapped in one frame that is really detrimental to our lives and to our planet.
Before you said that in Oslo, the downtown doesn't have mixed use, so it was easier to get rid of the cars, you know, for the most part. But when you talk about mixed use, how can you have mixed use? Residential, well, I get it, people can walk to shop or walk to work, but if they need their cars, where do they put them? And in fact, in this book, Bicycle City, you talk about cities as bicycle light, L-I-T-E. You're not saying that we're going to get rid of all cars. So how does that mix happen?
So that mix happens in a lot of ways. And I think I tried to not be super specific and prescriptive about solutions, because there's a lot of great design guides already out there that I reference in the book. There's a lot of people who have done the specific work, but also it really depends on the place. Car light in a small town in a rural area is absolutely doable, but it looks really different than car light in the center of Manhattan.
Give an example, because I live in a town which used to be rural, is now, and then I called it semi-rural, it's becoming increasingly suburban. And we have an on-demand, as of 2 years ago, we have an on-demand bus, which is really nice to have, because before that we had basically no public transportation. But bikes are still an issue, because there are a lot of bike accidents here. People are not used to looking out for bikes. There are not really proper bike lanes. So how does it work in smaller towns or suburban areas?
In smaller towns or suburban areas, the easiest, fastest, and cheapest way to change things is to set up zones where the speed limits are reduced a little bit. Speed is really what kills cyclists. The faster cars are going, the less reaction time they have, the less ability they have to see and respond when there's a cyclist on the road, and the worse the crash is going to be. So simply just, you know, 30-mile-an-hour zones is a great start. Then infrastructure accordingly. And so what infrastructure accordingly could mean is that, you know, the Dutch have this approach where they say the bigger the speed difference, between the cars and the bikes and the pedestrians, the more or the better infrastructure you need. And I think that that's a really good guidepost for what we're talking about. So if you've got a 60 mile an hour road, you want to have physical separation between people riding their bikes and people walking and the cars. If you have a 30 mile an hour road, a 25 mile an hour road, a 15 mile an hour zone, then you can have much less separation and you can have paint or you can have some plastic bollards. So I think that that's the general prescription to how to do that. But it also, especially in small towns and suburban places, there is this perception that bikes can't be there. Like it's just antithetical and it doesn't work. And that's absolutely not true. But that perception stops places from doing even basic things. And the research tells us that even basic things like just paint on the road, it's really cheap and it works. It helps make people safer and it gets more people out. So the other, I think, prescription is that anything is usually better than nothing.
You say this is an inflection point, our time that we have now in the history of cities. And you say it can determine the fate of the planet because, of course, transportation emissions are a huge contributor to the climate crisis. You peg that inflection point to three recent developments, and I'm just going to list them, and then I'd like us to talk about each one. First is the advent of e-bike technology and shared bicycle mobility that is kind of like the city bike program in New York, where people can rent bikes by the hour. The second is the introduction of more cargo bikes, which was a surprise to me because I always think about cargo bikes as being these hugely unwieldy things, but they are not so much anymore. And three was the demand for a better way to travel in our cities that came out of the pandemic. You say the pandemic had really a huge impact, in fact, creating a kind of bicycle boom. So let's start with the first, e-bikes, e-bike technology. Tell us about what's going on in that space.
The first thing that's happening is it's dominating the bike market. E-bikes are just taking over. They are becoming the bike that is being sold more than any other bike. And so from that respect, there's just a lot more e-bikes are coming out on the road. From a user perspective and from the perspective of the book and thinking about how we can change the way we travel and change our cities, e-bikes reduce a lot of the traditional barriers to riding a bicycle for a lot of people. You know, they're at a very basic sense, you know, they're much easier to ride. And the research reflects that when it's easier to ride, people ride a lot more and a lot more frequently and for a lot more different purposes and a lot further. And that last part is really important because then that means that e-bikes can act more like car replacements in more situations than a standard bicycle did in the past.
Now, I always worry about things like, you know, the weather, or rain, or just carrying things. First of all, talk a little bit about the weather, especially in light of the fact that on a warming planet, people, at least in some areas, are going to have fewer and fewer times when they're even going to want to go outside in something that can't be air conditioned.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think that maybe one thing to step back and think to remember is that there's no silver bullets here. It's, you know, we're looking at slices of a pie to try to get to a larger whole. So sure, a bicycle is not going to be the solution for everybody, and an e-bike isn't going to be a solution all the time for everyone. But that being said, in Norway, there's this saying of there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad equipment, or bad clothing, I guess, is what they say here. And it really is true, but there is also a social component to that. All of my neighbors are getting out, and they've got, you know, studded tires on their bicycles to ride in the ice and snow, which is actually safer than walking across sheets of ice. And they've got their standard winter gear and stuff like that. And so I see that, and I then mimicked that and kind of got into that. So that works for the cold. For the very warm weather, there's urban design solutions that are being implemented but need to be implemented to a much greater extent. And that's just simple things like street trees, adding the amount of shade and enclosure in cities. That goes a long way to reducing the ambient temperature and making it easier to ride more often. But then the other great thing about the e-bike when you're talking about hot weather is you don't exert yourself as much. So, you know, you're not getting to work covered in sweat the way that you might be with a regular bike.
And so now talk a little bit about cargo bike. While reading this book, Daniel Piotrkowski, Bicycle City, I went online and I saw some really kind of manageable cargo bikes. They don't just have this big, huge bin in the front.
Yeah, the world of cargo bikes is really exciting and really rapidly changing. And it's something that I didn't think was going to be as big of a part of the book as it became. And I didn't think that I would be so enthusiastic about it until I started researching the wider topic and understanding it. Because, yeah, as you say, there's everything from smaller cargo bikes that are really, they're the same dimensions essentially as a normal bike, but they're just kind of spaced a little differently so you can put more stuff for more kids on the back. And then there are the more standard ones that you would see with the big box up front. But they are changing all the time. Cargo bikes, because with the advent of the e-batteries, now they're becoming easy to ride. In the past, they used to be really a literal drag to carry, to get up and down hills with. Now they're so easy to get around on. So more people are using them. And we have research that's suggesting that, you know, they can replace one of two family cars in a lot of situations. You know, they really, the use cases are pretty extraordinary with the advent of the e-battery. And because of that, the market's expanding and a lot of people are getting in there and they're creating all sorts of different variations on the standard cargo bike for people, for, you know, families, for individuals who need to carry stuff. And then on the other side, there's freight and cargo bikes and delivery and cargo bikes. And that's a whole other planet of stuff and, you know, a different level of equipment needed to carry hundreds of thousands of pounds of deliveries and things like that.
But there's one caveat, I think, or one thing that might make it a little problematic for people to buy an e-bike, and that's the safety issue with fires. Not only e-bikes, but also e-scooters. So address that issue.
I'm glad you brought that up because it's something that it hasn't been as big of an issue in Europe because there's been more and more strict regulation of the batteries themselves, the bikes, like the entire, all of the technology has been more regulated in ways that have been overwhelmingly positive for e-bikes. Whereas in the U.S., I talked to a lot of people in the U.S. who say, well, look, I was on the bike path and somebody flew by me on an e-bike that was going 35 miles an hour. And, you know, you can't do that in Europe. The bikes are not allowed to go that quickly. They're speed limited and the technology is limited. So you don't get kind of like the tinkerer in their garage strapping a lawnmower engine onto a bike and then riding it on the bike path. And so, like, you don't have a lot of those problems that are really legitimate and significant challenges in the U.S. And what that says is that we really need some policy mechanisms to guarantee the quality of these batteries, the equipment, the technology. And it's something that People for Bikes and the League of American Bicyclists, you know, they're working towards this, particularly People for Bikes. They're the lobbying group for bike makers. And they've been working really hard. They have sort of their standards for what constitutes an actual e-bike. And it has to do with the quality of the technology, but it also has a speed component and the fact that the bike has to be pedaled for the motor to engage. But this is a space that needs regulation.
And why is that last qualification so important?
Because then you don't have motorcycles masquerading as bicycles.
You mentioned policy. You talk about another policy, transportation justice. What is transportation justice and what kinds of policies do we need?
Transportation justice, I'm trying to think of a good short definition of it. It's that transportation should serve all people is maybe a good starting point. And it's about, I guess, related to that is transportation equity, where transportation needs to meet people where they are.
You link it in the book to policies like e-bikes for low-income people, which is something that's happening in a few cities. How do they work?
So one aspect of transportation justice is certainly ensuring access to things like e-bikes and cargo bikes. And a big component of that is incentive programs or rebate programs or discount programs, those kinds of things. And the way that frequently they work is someone will buy a bike and then they will get a rebate from the municipality they live in. I believe that's how Denver has a program that's been extended, and I think that that's how that program works. And the idea is to make it accessible for people with lower incomes to get into e-bikes and e-cargo bikes.
Upfront rebates, I think, are much more effective because sometimes people don't have enough money to buy the bikes upfront and then go get the rebate. But
100%, yeah.
Another issue is actually the Inflation Reduction Act, which despite its name is really a lot of it is about decarbonizing our economy, going to clean energy. It was originally supposed to include rebates for e-bikes, and I believe upfront rebates, because a lot of the rebates in the rebates in the program, the IRA programs, are for middle and low-income people to put in heat pumps and solar panels and upgrade their electric and et cetera. And they are upfront rebates that go to the installer or the manufacturer first for people who meet the income guidelines. But they were cut out. Why do you think that happened? I mean, it really seems to be a tragic mistake. And then let's talk about the rebates that stayed in for electric vehicles. What are some of the problems with electric vehicles?
Well, I appreciate the fact that you link it to electric vehicles because that is the issue. Electric vehicles have really just sucked all the oxygen out of the conversation about decarbonizing transportation. And that I think that's the answer to this whole question. Electric vehicles are an easy sell for a lot of reasons, and they have a lot of advocacy behind them that e-bikes do not have. And so the thing that electric vehicles do is they promise us everything without having to change anything, except we get to buy a shiny new car. And so that is the problem. An electric vehicle says that we can continue to drive all the time. We can live in cities where driving all the time is the only option, but we'll decarbonize our whole system and we'll save the planet. And unfortunately, that is really not true. So much of transportation emissions come from building that city that is much bigger than it needs to be. It's not just the roads, it's the sewers and it's the sewer lines, it's the power lines, it's everything we have to do to make our cities big and sprawling is carbon intensive. But instead of addressing that larger systemic issue, we can just buy e-vehicles and feel better about ourselves.
Then talk about micro-mobility. You talk about e-scooters as well. Let's talk about them. I do see them on the roads around here, even in this rural area. But of course, I think they're much more appropriate to an urban environment. And they seem to have occasioned a lot of outrage. So talk about the controversy and how to deal with the problems that they may cause.
Yeah. To start with the controversy, the one thing, as a researcher who's been studying bicycling and walking and you know, non-motorized modes and non-auto modes, it's almost funny to see that, oh, the newest thing, now everybody hates it. You know, before e-scooters, everybody was mad about bicycles. So now at least we have e-scooters to be mad about and people aren't honking at me as much when I'm riding my bike. But I mean, that's sort of true. But I think that the other thing about e-scooters is they're challenging what we think should be in our transportation system. They're challenging what we think about how we should be using streets. And that's unpleasant. And it's occasionally dangerous. And it points out a lot of the problems already existing or that have existed in our transportation systems for a long time. We can address that by saying, get the e-scooters out of here. And that's not really solving the larger problem because people are using them. So obviously there's a use for them. Or what we can do is say, hey, how can our system be more flexible, be more accommodating to more people who need transportation to do more in more situations than it currently is?
And finally, you advocate for a systems approach, not one that focuses on individual decisions to maybe buy this or that product. What is a systems approach? I mean, I think you've talked a bit about it, but maybe tie it up in one grand answer.
Okay, yeah. At its core, a systems approach is changing where we identify the problem and then therefore what solution we use to remedy that problem. So for example, if we are talking about how bicyclists and pedestrians are getting killed on our streets, an individual approach might be to say, well, they need to wear brighter clothing. They need to signal better with their arms or whatever when they're turning. They need to have helmets. These individuals need to do something. A systems approach, however, would be to say, what is the broader system doing to make the fact that people are getting killed possible? And so then we can say, well, we're allowing really high speed traffic right next to kids walking to school, for example. Maybe we should have a system where we don't allow that to occur within the system. Then, by addressing a systemic issue, we're going to get rid of the problem of kids getting killed on their walk to school instead of blaming the kid for how they may or may not be acting. So I think that might be the most salient example I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, it's an example that you did experience when you saw an accident in Oslo, where a bicyclist was killed by a truck. And the response of the city was to come in and really figure out what happened and what they needed to do to make sure it didn't happen again.
Yeah, and crucially there, the city said, what can we do to change this physical location?
Well, it's really a terrific book and so many great ideas. Dan Piatkowski, your book is Bicycle City: Riding the Bike Boom to a Brighter Future. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Daniel Piatkowski is Associate Professor of Integrated Land Use and Transportation Planning at Oslo Metropolitan University. Bicycle City is out from Island Press. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.